Hey, it's Dr. Jamie, and red light therapy has become the latest trend in bio-optimization and in the beauty space, and you can find red light laser therapy offered at dermatology clinics, promising to reverse the signs of aging in the skin, treat acne, promote scar healing. Red light helps your mitochondria, you guys, and the mitochondria is in the skin cells, and it helps absorb those photons. And if we can remember from high school biology, the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. It generates the energy for the cell to perform its functions. Some of the reported benefits of red light therapy include reduction of fine lines and wrinkles, treatment of acne, healing of scars, treatment of seasonal affective disorder, increasing the healing of wounds, reducing painful joint inflammation, and increasing the recovery time between your strenuous workouts. If you want the red light I'm using, you're going to want to shop Cozy Red Lights. At Cozy, they offer simple, non-invasive at-home red light therapy devices that are easy to use and effective. Their devices emit 660 to 850 nanometers of red light and near-infrared waves that are clinically proven to penetrate deep into the skin to exert effects on a cellular level. You can use my code DRFIT, D-R-F-I-T, to start your red light journey today. Go check out the Cozy Red Lights. To the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Jamie, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. I am so excited that you're tuning in with us today because I have an amazing guest, and we're talking about a really important topic that might be new to you. So thanks for listening to all of our previous episodes. And if this topic is interesting to you, please download the podcast, share it with all your friends and family, share it to your social media. You help us get these messages all over the world. Well, on today's podcast, my special guest is Dr. Anthony Jay. He is a husband and a father, an avid outdoorsman, scientist, and award-winning author. Dr. Jay has been the president of the International Medical Research Collaborative, a nonprofit organization that provided training to international medical students and doctors. He is also the CEO of AJ Consulting Company, which specializes in scientific consulting, speaking, and personalized DNA analysis. He earned his PhD in biochemistry from Boston University School of Medicine and earned a Bachelor of Arts with a double major in biology and theology from Ave Maria University, Florida. His professional scientific work has been published in leading medical and science journals and presented at global venues such as the International Conference on Alzheimer's Disease and the Kern Lipid Conference. Dr. Jay also received the Early Career Investigator Award in 2014. Dr. Anthony Jay, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I should have sent you my short bio, I guess. Well,
people deserve to hear all of the praise for the work that you're doing. So I first came across your work when you wrote your book called Estrogenation. And I want to dive into that topic because as a OBGYN and a mom of three daughters, this is something that is extremely important to me, especially taking care of pregnant patients. So can you kind of tell us, basically tell our listeners what estrogenic substances like really means, because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah, for sure. So basically even natural estrogen is an estrogenic, right? So estradiol, estrone, estriol, those are natural estrogens. They're estrogenic. They act on your estrogen receptors. They act like estrogen in your body. The problem is there's a lot of chemicals in our environment that also act like estrogen in our body. They act on the estrogen receptor. So BPA is a good example. Like you said, the phthalates, the parabens, some of the red food colorings. There's a bunch of them. Atrazine is a herbicide that acts like estrogen. And the reason these chemicals can act like estrogen, you know, because sometimes people, I was on Mark Bell's podcast and he says, well, what about testosterone? Where are the chemicals that act like testosterone? I want some of those, you know? And the problem is testosterone, the whole system is very simple. It's just, you have testosterone, you have one testosterone receptor. It's called the androgen receptor. And that's it. But estrogen, because you have three estrogens, it's more complicated. It would be like having three different testosterones, right? That's a complicated thing. So you have three estrogens and then you have two different receptors that pick up estrogen. So scientists call those receptors promiscuous, which is kind of a funny way to think about it, but that's just the technical term for estrogen receptors, meaning they bind to a lot of different, they partner with a lot of different things. So they're not very specific, you know, like normally with you have a receptor, it's very specific, like testosterone, it just binds that one thing. But with estrogen, you find these receptors will stick to all kinds of different things, which is fine if you only have natural estrogens. But yeah, if you've got all these fake estrogens in your body from petroleum products and man-made chemicals, well, then you suddenly are disrupting the system. And that's a real problem for fertility, for your testosterone levels, for weight gains, you know, post, you know, like people talk about postpartum depression. Well, I talk about artificial estrogen depression. It's the same sort of thing. You're messing up your estrogen, you're messing up your hormones. There's an increased risk of all of that stuff with these chemicals.
So when you're talking about this promiscuity of the estrogen receptor, for people, just to give you an analogy, so think of it like a lock and a key. That something like testosterone, there's basically one key, one lock. That's what, you know, turns it on and sends the signal. But with estrogen receptors, it's like a lock that a lot of different keys can turn it on. Is that an okay analogy?
Yeah, perfect. I'm there. Oh yeah, that's classic. Yeah.
Yeah. And then another thing people maybe don't know is that a lot of our natural occurring estrogens are made from testosterone. So you need testosterone to make those natural estrogens. They get what we call aromatized. And that can be a good or a bad thing, because there's people that do that at a higher rate than other people, and too much even natural estrogen can be a problem. So like in my OBGYN world, people that don't, I always kind of call estrogen like a use it and lose it. It's an amazing hormone. It's very anti-inflammatory. It's a good thing, but it goes through different pathways to get out of our body. And if you have these extra estrogens and extra keys, like constantly turning the lock, it can certainly cause problems. So what would be like, if you were to give a top 10 list for people listening of things that they wouldn't even think about that might be estrogenic, and what problems do these cause? You kind of alluded to like depression and infertility and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the top 10 list, I mean, I wrote about it in my book. What I did when I wrote this book, Estrogeneration, I specifically, for my own personal life, I wanted to know what chemicals are we being exposed to every day that act like estrogen? Because like Agent Orange messes up your hormones, right? But we're not exposed to Agent Orange every day, hopefully, or hopefully never exposed to that. And we are exposed to BPA pretty frequently, and people oftentimes don't realize some of these sneaky sources where you can find it, you know, like straws or something like that. So BPA would make my list, of course. And so do the analogs for BPA. I kind of lump those together, just like BPA. I just call them bisphenols because that's what they're called. So yeah. Bisphenol A, bisphenol S, bisphenol F, bisphenol AF. You can put all kinds of different letters on the end. They all act like estrogen. And it's a category of plasticizers or plastic chemicals. And by the way, in the 1920s, there was a guy, his last name was Dodds, Charles Dodds. He was the main researcher who studied BPA as a birth control. That was the reason BPA was developed. It was specifically developed as birth control. And then when they discovered it can be used to make plastics, of course, the whole thing shifted, and they saw that was a more financially successful, you know, venture. But anyways, BPA is number one. Phthalates would be number two. Phthalate is a big category of chemicals. It's not just one chemical. You know, there's hundreds of phthalates, unfortunately, which means scientists have not done a lot of research on all the different phthalates. And the ones that they have, shoot, they act like estrogen, just like BPA. So it's frustrating, because oftentimes you see BPA free on a label, and they'll use BPF or BPAF or whatever, and those act like estrogen. Or they'll use something with a lot of phthalates, and those act like estrogen. For example, you know, you've heard of polyester, like polyester clothing.
Right.
The old term for that is polyethylene terephthalate, right? And even the clothing and stuff is being made from plastics now in a lot of cases. And it's particularly bad, at least on the studies that I've seen, if you're laying on it all night, like you're breathing it in all night, like a pillowcase. You don't want a polyester pillowcase. I don't care how good it feels. You want organic cotton or something, or just regular cotton, like much better than plastic, you know? And even underwear and stuff, I'm not a huge fan of polyester, except if you're running a marathon or something where you just temporarily need something that's very non-abrasive. But otherwise, I'm not a big fan of underclothing that's polyester in general. But I'm maybe getting nitpicky there. The crib mattresses and stuff for babies, they've done studies on that. It causes a lot of emissions into the air. And again, they're breathing it in, it's disrupting their hormones, it's a noticeable effect that they can quantify, it's a problem. So phthalates make the list, parabens make the list. And just like the phthalates, it's a whole category. So there's methylparaben, there's propylparaben, there's butylparaben. This is another big category, and they have not studied a lot of them, but when they do study them, they mostly act like estrogen. And so there's different degrees. And the other problem is sometimes one of them doesn't act that strongly like estrogen, but then your body breaks it down into a different form of paraben that acts really strongly like estrogen. So it gets all kinds of confusing when you're reading the studies. But I don't like parabens. I'm not a fan in the fragrances and the perfumes. And by the way, a lot of times they put phthalates in the fragrances and perfumes. A lot of these fragrance chemicals that are made from petroleum act like estrogen. They mess with your hormones. So be careful with fragrances for people at home. You know, if you don't know, just go fragrance free.
And it's not just like colognes and perfumes. It's like wall plugins. I mean, everything has like fragrance these days.
I know they've even done research on laundry detergents. They call these studies dermal uptake studies. So they have people that wear clothing that is from this fragrancy laundry detergent, and then people with this fragrance free laundry detergent. And the people with that fragrancy stuff, it goes through their skin. You know, you would think it doesn't, because it's like, well, how does that little amount of fragrance end up going through skin? It raises your blood levels. It's quantifiable. And so obviously that's enough for me to say, I don't want fragrance even in my laundry detergent. And it's amazing when you get away from those fragrances, because like we'll go to the in-laws and they'll have just regular laundry detergent. Sometimes I've got kids, we got to do the laundry. That stuff persists for weeks. Like we'll do multiple cycles with fragrance-free detergent. Yeah. And you can still smell the damn detergent. It's amazing how long it persists even in the clothes.
I remember going to a gym recently and they provide towels, and I had gotten off the stair climber and didn't want to like deface. I was dripping. And it was just this like robust, like downy softener, Tide, whatever. I like was like nauseous. Right. Like soaked in fragrance. Exactly. And I've heard too that, you know, it's very misleading. Like it will just say fragrance on a label, right? Mm-hmm. But that could mean thousands of different chemicals, right? It's
exactly
the rules of how they can label these products.
Yep. So if it just has the word fragrance and there's no details about it, be careful with that. Unless you really trust the company. Some companies are really trustworthy, but not all of them and not most of them, you know? Be careful with fragrances, be careful with the parabens. So that's a couple of them. And then of course, getting in more into the foods, I'm not a fan of soy. I know a lot of people argue about this and discuss about this, but I'll tell you, the research is tricky with soy. And by the way, soy definitely acts like estrogen. No scientist debates that. People that study soy all agree it acts like estrogen. They just argue about whether it's good for you or bad for you. And my thing is, look, we've got all these estrogen chemicals we're being exposed to. Why do you want another one? You know, and the other aspect of it, if you do a scientific study, like let's say you're looking at breast cancer, right? Because breast cancer is up 250% since 1980. It's way up. And sure enough, it's linked to all these chemicals. And all we're doing as a society is passing out pink ribbons and asking for money to raise awareness for breast cancer, which is silly because nobody's raising awareness for the chemicals that are causing the breast cancer and the elimination of the chemicals, but they're just raising awareness that breast cancer exists, which is crazy. But, you know, people make money with these schemes, right? But the soy, if you take big enough groups of people and you look at people with and without soy in their diets, you're not really going to find an increase in breast cancer. Does that mean it's not related? Or does that mean we're just completely saturated with a ton of other estrogens and you can't really distinguish the difference? I predict that it's probably because people are so washed out with estrogens that it's not having that much of an impact. But again, if you're really trying to be careful with estrogens, I'm a fan of avoiding soy. And you can get even more nuanced if you really want. I can go into the details about the different types of receptors, and because there's two estrogen receptors, like I mentioned before, one's called alpha and one's called beta. And the alpha receptor is the bad one. It's the troublemaker in most cases. That's the one that increases risk of breast cancer. It increases prostate cancer in men. It's a problem. And it's only supposed to be activated in the womb, the alpha receptor. And then it's supposed to turn off, and that's supposed to be the end of it. But of course, most of these estrogen chemicals that I'm talking about, like the BPAs and all this stuff, they activate that alpha receptor. They activate that troublemaker receptor. And the beta receptor, the other estrogen receptor, that's the good one. That's the other lock and key, but that's like the one that's more healthy for you. That's protective against breast cancer. It's protective against prostate cancer. It's good for your arteries. It's protective against Alzheimer's. It has all these benefits. You want to activate that beta receptor. And so you could make an argument that soy activates the beta receptor, but it doesn't. It activates both. I've looked at the studies, right? So there's some disparity. It's like some tissues, it activates the alpha. Some tissues, it activates the beta. Some people, it activates alpha. Some people, it activates beta. Meaning some people are probably healthy, but who knows? Like, it's hard to figure out those people. But in scientific studies, you do find those people on both sides of that. So I guess that's like the really deep information on soy. I'm not a fan of it. Once again, I've researched it really heavily, but I recognize that a lot of people, you know, push for it, promote it, especially the vegan community. I've been invited on podcasts and then uninvited because they find out that I'm not a fan of soy.
Well, we're seeing like soy-based infant formulas.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, and there's research, like if you Google soy infant formula and glyphosate, you'll find it's additive. Like glyphosate plus soy equals 1 + 1 = 2 estrogen. Like it's double the estrogen. So some of these things amplify the estrogenic activity. And that's the last thing you want with your babies, in my opinion. Let their natural hormones kind of do their own thing. Don't be pumping a bunch of exogenous like substances from the outside into their system that are going to alter those hormones. But yeah, like I say, soy, flax makes my list too, because when they did a study looking at which plants have estrogen chemicals, not really chemicals, they're phytoestrogens, just natural, natural chemicals the plants make that act like estrogen.
Yeah,
phytochemicals. They did a study in Canada with a huge amount of foods, like all plant foods, broccoli, kale, cauliflower, whatever, just hundreds of plants. All of them were under 1,000 units of estrogen, except for soy and flax. And soy and flax were over 100,000 units. So, you know, those are the two that really strongly act like estrogen. So I avoid those two. And again, flax is the same nuance where, yeah, you know, you can find studies where it's beneficial, but it has CBD. Flax actually has cannabinoids, so it's anti-inflammatory from that. So it has some yin yang here. Flax has omega-3s. A lot of people need omega-3s, you know? So like, in my opinion, get your omega-3s from fish and avoid the estrogens from flax. And that's kind of the best of both worlds. If you need CBD, go and get actual hemp CBD. And that's the best of both worlds there. So there's alternatives. You don't have to do the flax thing, but it's become popular in health circles.
What do you think about soy and flax for postmenopausal women who are low estrogen state?
It's too risky because you're not sure if you're activating alpha or beta. I like just actual natural bioavailable estrogen. I like natural progesterone. I don't like Premarin, you know what I mean, from horses. I like actual testosterone. I like replacing all three postmenopause, not just estrogen, progesterone. I even like to make sure that people are paying attention to testosterone. And if they need that, boost that up too. You feel a lot better. You have more energy. You recover faster. But that's my approach, is just go bioavailable, go real, you know, go natural. And that's a lot less risky. And yeah, I know doctors sometimes will tell you it increases risk of breast cancer if you take estradiol postmenopause. It doesn't. I think that's been debunked. I've looked at the studies. I disagree with that idea. It doesn't cause breast cancer. There's a book called Estrogen Matters where they really go through the details. It's an MBA. A medical doctor and a PhD scientist that wrote this book, Estrogen Matters. If people are worried about that, read that book.
Yeah, there was a large study. I just shared it recently on my social media, very large, you know, population looking at women who had breast cancer, who had estrogen exposure versus no estrogen exposure. And there was zero difference between the groups. The only difference was seen in women who took synthetic progestins. So synthetic, you know, progesterones, you know, levonorgestrel, norethindrone acetate, anything that basically wasn't micronized progesterone. So that's a very common question that I get in my clinic on a, you know, daily basis. And for postmenopausal hormone use, you know, we really only see about one extra woman per 1,000 taking it. And, you know, I think that a lot of women who would benefit are persuaded away from it by some of the misinformation, even from some of their own doctors. When you have mentioned some of these xenoestrogens and their risk of, you know, breast cancer, it's like if we want to look at absolute risk reduction, like there's so many other things like alcohol use and all these other things that could massively reduce your risk. And then we're, you know,
they're not even mentioned
in the debate of like, oh, I'm not going to touch that. It's going to cause breast cancer. And a lot of women will tell me their mother had breast cancer and it was from her hormone replacement therapy. I hear that all the time. And so that's, definitely something that's out there.
Right. Exactly. And who knows? I mean, maybe they were taking some weird fake version of estrogen, you know, like 17 alpha phenylestradiol instead of just natural estrogen. But, you know, most people don't know the difference and the doctors should. And I think the information's gotten out there nowadays more and more, thankfully.
I think we're seeing the pendulum swing. That's for sure. What other things in somebody's house would they not think about when it comes to these kind of environmental chemical estrogens?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I don't know, everybody's different, but I think the plastic water situation is out of hand, out of control in this country.
You mean like plastic water bottles?
Yeah, people are putting water in plastics even after they filter it. And yeah, if it's in there a little bit, it's not a big deal, but the longer it sits in plastic, the more leaching you get. The hotter it is, by the way, the more leaching you get. So I prefer just to store water in glass at home or stainless steel if I'm traveling and things. And, obviously once in a while you can have some plastic, right? It's not that big of a deal. Your body will clear that stuff out. But if you're constantly drinking out of plastic, you're probably overdoing estrogens. And the coffee makers and the whole thing, like think about all the plastics people are doing.
I was just about to ask, yeah, like Starbucks cups or,
they're plastic lined, yeah.
Hot tea, hot coffee, yeah, styrofoam.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not a paper cup. Like there's no such thing that would leak. They have plastic they spray inside of there and it's oftentimes BPA. Even in the soda cans, you should see that there's a YouTube video where they put a regular soda can in really strong hydrochloric acid. So it dissolves all the aluminum, but the plastic stays there. And it literally is like half the can is aluminum. The other half is like plastic and you can lift it up and the soda stays in there. It's a plastic bottle. Soda cans are plastic bottles, beer bottles that are actually like soda cans, the aluminum cans for beer, all that stuff, that's plastic. So that's kind of sneaky for people because they don't think about that because they're doing these seltzer waters or whatever, these calorie-free water things.
Right.
Make it at home. Like if you're really addicted to that stuff and you really love it, I do. I got one of those drink
mates. I've seen them. I don't own one, but
it's a CO2 infuser. Yeah. You push a button, it pumps some CO2 in your water. You keep it cold. I keep it in the fridge cold in a big glass pitcher, pour it in the thing, pump CO2 into it, put some essential oil, some stevia, boom. It's amazing. Like citrus essential oil, like tangerine oil or something, one drop of that. And I've got myself basically a soda. So there's alternatives to all this stuff. Some of it's more dramatic than other things, but at least don't store your water in plastic on a day-to-day thing. And similar with hot foods, like liquids, people are always asking me, well, what about my sandwich or whatever? It's like, it's dry, it's solid. It's not going to leach, but liquids are going to leach. So if you take a bunch of hot soup and you put it in plastic Tupperware dishes, you're going to get a lot of leaching. They've done these studies. It's astonishing how high the leaching is. And you don't want those types of chemicals from those products.
I'm literally picturing myself in college making macaroni and cheese in these little microwavable cups. And I'm trying to imagine the chemical bomb that is, for.
Yeah. And those microwave dinners that are in those black plastic things, that black plastic is recycled electronics, like electrical cords and stuff. That's where that comes from. Like the black forks, the plastic forks you see at fast food places. There's a lot of stuff. And again, once in a while, you're on the road, you're at Chipotle, grab a black fork. You know what I mean? Like, but if you're doing that every day, you got to figure something else out. Grab a regular steel fork, bring it in your pocket. Again, if you're doing it every day, pay more attention because you have to do something different, in my opinion. Because the real problem here is not that you're going to get migraines. It's not that you're going to get bloating. Like if you're dairy sensitive, you're going to feel it, right? The problem with plastics is you don't feel it. That's the real problem because it's not very motivating, or estrogenics in general, these chemicals in general. And scientists make it worse because they tell you it's okay. A lot of scientists will say, well, I've looked at the toxicity studies and BPA is okay. you have to have kilograms before it'll kill you, they'll say. And I've heard it a million times. And that's because bisphenol A, BPA, doesn't kill you. It doesn't kill cells. If you have cells growing in a dish and you put a bunch of these chemicals in there, they think it's estrogen. The cells are like, oh, this is totally cool. Now, obviously, it screws up their metabolism and it causes weird issues with them, but it doesn't kill them. So yeah, it's not really toxic. And that's part of the problem here is it's, you know, the toxicity studies are deceptive when you're talking about screwing up your hormones, and especially because they're not doing long-term studies most of the time. In fact, sunscreen is one of the top 10 list chemicals, oxybenzone that I have. And I haven't even mentioned that one. But
yeah, let's talk about sunscreen because I get asked about this a lot on social media. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, and sunscreen, there's obviously good ones out there, right? There's zinc sunscreen. You can find ones without oxybenzone and all the nasty stuff in it. There's another chemical called 4-methylbenzaldehyde camphor, also estrogenic, also very bad. But oxybenzone is the most common. If you go to Walmart or whatever and you just look at the sunscreens, you're just going to find all of them have oxybenzone except just one brand or something like that. Okay. And oxybenzone acts like estrogen. First of all, that should be a red flag. But they recently did a study after I published my book, unfortunately, but they did a study where they did one application of sunscreen on people, just one, and they measured their blood levels of oxybenzone. 7 days later, it was still above the government's safety limits. And the safety limits by the government are ridiculously high. Like they're way above what they should be because again, right. It's kind of deceptive, with these chemicals because they don't kill you. They just screw up your hormones. So we were in like the cancer causing levels with oxybenzone from one application of sunscreen. So you're increasing your risk of something you're supposed to be protecting against, which is cancer, right? So obviously I'm not a fan of that. Obviously I need sunscreen if you look at me, but what I do is I just wear a sun shirt. I wear a sun hat. I wear sun gloves. I wear a buff when I go out fishing and stuff, but that's after 20 minutes of sunshine. I make sure to get sunshine for 20 minutes. I set a timer because sunshine is super beneficial. It breaks up bilirubin. It, you know, obviously vitamin D, everybody knows about that, but it increases your metabolism through something called melanotan, you know, your melanocortin receptor. It detoxes you, right? It breaks down heavy metals. If you have a tattoo, you'll know this. Your tattoo will fade away with sunshine exposure. It has all these interesting benefits that people never talk about because they just think about vitamin D and they think supplementing it somehow will just cover all their bases. But obviously at some point you get overexposed to sunshine and then it suddenly becomes bad for you. And even there, again, sun shirts, sun hats, sun gloves, you know, like, or zinc sunscreen.
Well, and we see headline after headline about, skin cancer, you know, wear your sunscreen, put sunscreen on your face morning and night, you know, for women before you put your makeup on, put sunscreen on, and we're seeing rising rates of skin cancer too. So do you think that these chemical sunscreens are contributing to that? Or do you think it's just all the other environmental things? And
yeah, I think for sure it's contributing. It takes too long for scientists to tease out with the data. In other words, the studies take more than 6 weeks and scientists don't want to do a 2-year study with something that they're not making money on. Mm-hmm. In fact, they'd be losing money if they find out something bad about oxybenzone. So the companies are very against, you know, like
no one's going to fund it. Yeah.
But they've even done fruit fly studies and obviously it's just a fly, but they find that oxybenzone shortens telomeres, it effectively shortens lifespan, it accelerates aging. So there is a possibility, and it's likely because the data is in that direction, that we're actually accelerating aging when we're putting all that stuff on our face, and you're going to get more wrinkles and that kind of thing if you're accelerating aging. So it's probably having the long-term opposite effect of what you want.
Interesting. I've seen some headlines recently about spray sunscreen and the aerosolization is actually significantly worse. Can you talk about the difference between the delivery method of these chemicals too?
I don't know enough about it. No.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that
I saw the studies. I saw what you're talking about too. I know what you're talking about, but I don't know enough about how it causes the problems. Do you know more about
it? Well, I mean, I think because when you put something in a can and it requires a propellant, it's just more chemicals than if you put a spray sunscreen side by side with a cream or a lotion or something like that, the spray is significantly worse. I mean, you're paying for the convenience of being able to, you know, just spray it on your kid. And I get it. I got three kids. To lather a kid with like white zinc oxide, you know, like it's not the most appealing thing, but I go to the pool and I can guarantee you that 9 out of 10 people there are getting out the can and, you know, spraying up and down.
I agree. Well, the sad thing is a lot of schools require spray sunscreen. That's why I put on my website, because I had parents come and say, well, I see your recommendations on your website, you know, because I have a website where I list stuff that I like, particularly products I use. I don't have an exhaustive list anywhere, but I do list products that I personally use. Like, well, here's the soap I use. It's pretty cheap. It doesn't have any chemicals in it that I don't like. You can use whatever the hell you want. Here's what I'm using. And so I have sunscreen on there. And a lot of parents were saying, well, where's your spray sunscreen? It's like, well, I don't use spray sunscreen. And then they say, well, my school demands it. They require it. It's like, wow. Okay, well, here's one that's good, right? So I have a spray sunscreen on my website, but it's only because of that. But I'm not surprised anytime you're increasing, you know, different chemicals. What I do with my kids is I get my hands wet and then I put the stuff on and then it lathers a lot quicker and easier. So I'm a sunscreen master.
I love it. I love it. You know, so I'm with oxybenzone, you know, you said they did the study where 7 days later, they still had detectable, you know, carcinogenic levels of oxybenzone. So these, you know, xenoestrogens, do they accumulate in the body? Do we, you know, are they lipophilic? Do we store them in our fat? Or if you had good, you know, chemical, I hate the word detoxification, but if you had good, you know, pathways to get rid of these things, would you be okay?
Yes, yes, and maybe yes. You know, it's for sure they store up in your body. They bioaccumulate. They did a study with polar bears in northern Alaska. 11 polar bears, they put them to sleep. They had all kinds of biopsies. They all had parabens in their fat cells and their livers and all kinds of stuff. And it works up the food chain, right? But they also store it. They store it.
Where are the polar bears getting it?
Well, it's from the ocean currents circulating these chemicals all the way up the food chain. So they're eating seals, and the seals are eating the fish, and the fish are getting it because they migrate or they have currents. Wow. Yeah, it's bad. And then they're wondering why they're becoming infertile, right? And they're blaming it on global warming. But it's like, well, there's chemicals too that we have to think about here, because if humans are becoming infertile from this stuff, you know, of course you'd expect the polar bears to get infertile from this stuff also. So yeah, it bioaccumulates, it stores up in the body, which is a problem because, again, if you're researching it and you're studying it for 6 weeks, you know, you're not going to see, you're not accounting for accumulation, and scientists usually don't. So bioaccumulation's problem. It does store in the fat cells. The average lifespan of a fat cell is 1.5 years. But they found with the atomic bomb studies, they found fat cells that are 10 years old in people. So you can have this stuff just chilling in your fat cells for a super long time. And in terms of how you detox it, there's a lot of variability. So that's part of one of my genetic things that I look for when I do DNA consulting, is I look at people's estrogen genes and how well their liver, like CYP1B1 is a gene specific to clearing a lot of these artificial estrogens. And people have different variants on that gene, and they're well known to increase risk of breast cancer or whatever, different types of estrogenic health risks. And so, you know, there is variability and in terms of your ability to clear this stuff out of your system. But the sauna is my favorite tool for this, because they do these studies, they're called BUS studies, blood, urine, and sweat. And people that, you know, they have a group of people and they measure the urine, and there's hardly any BPA, hardly any phthalates. And you can Google this, it's just called BPA BUS study, you know, look up BPA BUS study or phthalates BUS study, whatever. And you'll find the studies, it's easy. And you'll see, it's interesting because hardly any BPA in their urine. So you would think like, oh, they're not that exposed to BPA. And you have those same people go into a sauna and sweat, and you measure their sweat and it's full of BPA, right? And scientists used to laugh at you if you said that you sweat out toxins and all this stuff. You absolutely do. And it's super well understood now, to the point I've had people laugh at me, right? Like when I was doing my PhD way back, I asked a scientist who was an expert in organic chemist. I wanted to know about aluminum and deodorant because I was using aluminum deodorant, you know, that aluminum tetraglycinate or whatever it is. And I said, like, do you think that stuff gets into your body? Because aluminum bioaccumulates, but aluminum can build up in your brain and cause problems and stuff. And he laughed and he's like, it's an inert metal, dude. Like, of course it doesn't get into your body. And it's funny because, like, literally about a year after he was laughing at me for that, a study came out where they actually looked at aluminum uptake from deodorant. And it's not a massive amount of uptake. It's very minor, but it definitely goes through your skin. And the fact that it bioaccumulates makes me nervous. So I switched to magnesium deodorant. You know what I mean? Because of course, if that goes into my system, that's awesome. You know, so, and it definitely
needs a little more mag.
Yeah. So yeah. Oftentimes, you know, you have to be careful with these researchers because they have egos and they're humans. And sometimes they've put a lot of effort into basically finding data that fits some kind of narrative or whatever. And they're very convinced. And, you know, there's sometimes a bigger picture, or maybe there's even funding behind the scenes where they're paid to think a certain direction. And that's very common also.
How do these estrogenics make us gain weight and make us fat?
Yeah, it's technically through a pathway called PPAR gamma, PPAR, Greek letter gamma, GAMMA. It's kind of like a fat storage switch. And the better analogy, instead of getting super technical, the better way to think about it for people is pregnancy, right? Because a lot of when women get pregnant, their estrogen goes way up. You know, it goes from like 200 to 2000, right? And that's a natural thing. That's good. And one of the things that does is it increases fat storage, right? Women gain weight. And that's a good thing. That's a natural thing because our ancestors didn't always have access to food. So we needed those extra fat stores because fat is the most efficient form of energy. So if you're starving, like you don't have food every day, like a lot of people didn't in our past history, well, now you've got a nice fat store. You can still have energy. The fetus is good to go. It's a survival mechanism. Now, obviously that's not a problem today, but you still store fat, right? If your estrogen goes way up, you're going to store more fat. And women know this that have been pregnant and things. Now the fake estrogens tell your body that you're pregnant. They kind of do the same thing. They basically tell your body like, hey, store more fat. You know, like our estrogen just shot way up. And obviously it's a perverse system. It's not the way it should be because these are now fake estrogens and you're not actually pregnant and you don't actually need fat storage. But one of the craziest studies on this was, it was a study with atrazine, and atrazine makes my top 10 list. It's a herbicide. It's the second most used herbicide in North America. After glyphosate, the Roundup chemical, atrazine is the most used. Hundreds of millions of pounds every year. Most people have never heard of it, unless you're a farmer or something. And in Europe, totally illegal. Atrazine, not even allowed because it screws up your hormones. It acts like estrogen. Like it turns male frogs into females. It feminizes males. It has all these estrogenic effects that Alex Jones used to talk about, right? And he was talking about gay frogs, but he was kind of missing. It's not really gay. It's just feminizing. It turns males to females. But the point is, they did a study with two groups of rats and gave them the exact same calories, which is cool because in rats, you can do that. In humans, you can't really do this. Exact same calories, exact same everything. The only difference with the two groups, one of the groups, they gave low dose atrazine, and they specifically said low dose to imitate the amounts that we're exposed to on a regular basis in rural America. That group got fat. The other group was totally normal, like lean rats. And that shows you how much these chemicals can alter your hormones and alter your weight, whether it's because your testosterone is lowering or because you're acting like estrogen and triggering that pregnancy signal. Sometimes it's both. Sometimes it's just one. Sometimes it's the other. It's complicated, right? I mean, we're talking about a top 10 list of chemicals, but there's probably a little bit of all of the above with all of the above chemicals.
Why does America allow this amount of chemicals, like in our food, in our pesticides?
It's politics. It's because the politicians are bought out with a lot of these big companies that have money. And in Europe, you don't have that. So like Michael Skinner, he's a PhD scientist, acquaintance of mine. He's out at Washington University. He did a TED talk and stuff. He's well known. He's a cool scientist. He studies a lot of these chemicals and he does generational studies. So he looks at, he exposes a mother mouse to BPA or to atrazine. He's done that one. A bunch of these chemicals. And then he looks at the next generation and how fat are they and how infertile are they and all this. And the next generation after that, he does like four generations out and he finds effects four generations out from one exposure to the mother. And he's like very pessimistic about it. He thinks we're like really getting screwed as a culture for our fertility in the future and stuff.
Yeah, like epigenetic changes that get passed down. Yeah,
exactly. That's what he studies. And like he grows like 5,000 mice at any given time. If you just show up at his lab, he's got insane numbers of mice growing, and it just costs insane amounts to keep that up with all the government regulations and stuff. But he does it. He's an awesome guy. But why did I bring up Skinner? I forget. What were you asking about? I'm sorry.
I said, why does America allow all these
chemicals? Oh, the allowance. Exactly. Yeah. So Skinner, Michael, this doctor, he went over to Europe and gave a talk showing the multi-generational effects of one specific herb. It's a fungicide. It's like a chemical spray they use to protect against fungus.
Yeah.
And they outlawed, like he had a bunch of government officials at that talk that he gave, and they outlawed that chemical 2 weeks later, literally. And in America, that talk was like 5 years ago. It's still totally legal, and it's totally just as bad for you. You know what I mean? And again, it's just because these chemical corporations are making huge money and they're very influential. So what it comes down to is people just have to independently recognize that these chemicals are all over the place, and you have to kind of take matters into your own hands to protect yourself from them. Because even if they make BPA illegal, which 17 states have done for certain children's products and baby bottles and stuff, even when they do that, the companies just turn around and might use BPS.
Yeah, I was just about to say, use BPA free as like a marketing scheme, and it's just another cousin to BPA.
That's exactly what they do. So even in that case, when the government tries to regulate this stuff, these companies are quick to just bait and switch people. And then people think that they're okay. So it's almost worse. But I'm a fan of, you know, making them illegal for food products and all that, but they just, it's tricky, right? And they definitely don't in America.
Wow. So let's switch from estrogen to talking about testosterone. How do these things, even though they're estrogenic, lower our testosterone, and what impact does that have for men and for women?
Yeah, they have three impacts on testosterone. Number one, they lower the total. Number two, they lower the free. And number three, they block binding to the testosterone receptor, the androgen receptor. So they have three problematic impacts. And blocking binding, you know, the analogy I use for that is like hockey, because I'm in Minnesota, I play hockey. I still play. I play in this league. It's pretty fun. It's called Hockey Finder. But, you know, you can use any sport for this. But if you have a piece of plywood and you put it in front of a hockey goalie, or like in front of the goal, it doesn't matter how many players you have on the ice, how many pucks you have on the ice, you're not going to score any goals, right? And that's the same thing. If you block binding to the testosterone receptor, it doesn't matter how much your testosterone is, like what's your level, who cares? Because you can't even use it. You're blocking the goals, right? You can't score any goals. You're blocking binding to the receptor. So that's probably the most insidious thing that you can have with this. And that's what you see. Now, actually how it lowers testosterone, nobody knows exactly. I mean, there's hypotheses and there's a lot of theories and stuff, but it definitely lowers it. It's probably, your body has some kind of a communication between your testosterone levels and your estrogen levels because of aromatization, like you mentioned a long time ago, meaning, you know, you can convert testosterone to estrogen. And so if your estrogen starts to go up, eventually it shuts that process off.
Right.
And like I say, exactly how that works, we don't actually understand right now, but it happens, right? And so even if it's not actual estrogen, even if your body's not converting testosterone to estrogen and raising estrogen, shutting off testosterone, if you're just exposing yourself to a bunch of these estrogen chemicals, it's telling your body like, hey, we've got tons of estrogen, shut off the testosterone production. It does the same thing. It communicates the same way.
And we're definitely seeing declining testosterone levels in both men and women. I don't know about your town, but in mine, there's testosterone clinics on many corners, a lot of people doing, you know, cash pay testosterone replacement, just take testosterone. You know, I think it's probably multifactorial, you know, metabolic disease, insulin resistance, chemicals, poor sleep,
magnesium, lack of exercise. Yeah.
All the things. But, okay. So we've talked about impact on fertility. We've talked about depression. We've talked about cancers. What are other maybe really subtle things that people could be dealing with? I mean, is kind of the sky the limit as far as symptomatology?
Well, what I did with my book is I looked at, you know, okay, I've got BPA, I've got phthalates, I've got whatever, atrazine. And you can compile kind of a list of the health impacts from that. If you look through the research really close, and my book has 400 references, I looked through the research really close. Now it's easy to read my book just so I don't scare people off. But, and I published a long time ago, like, you know, I've sold a ton of copies already. I don't feel like I have to sell my book anymore, but if people want to read it, it's easy to read. But what I did when I was writing it was I kind of compiled a list and said, look, what are the health impacts from BPA exposures? And I kind of made a list. And what are the health impacts from atrazine exposures? And I made a list. And obviously there's going to be a few outliers, like red food coloring creates, it seems to trigger a lot of ADHD, like attention deficit in certain groups of people. But that's not like an estrogen effect. That's probably just a separate effect from that specific chemical. But it also changes like the, you know, it feminizes males, right? Well, that's probably kind of lumped in this group of estrogenic effects, right? So I kind of just started looking for things that are common, you know, common problems from all these chemicals. And again, in my book, I think I found 7 of them. Obviously, there's like a little bit here and a little bit there, but that's basically what I came out with.
Okay. So it seems like all of these things are unavoidable. Like I can imagine somebody listening right now and they're like, oh my God, like the water and the plastics and everything. And if I can't use sunscreen and I can't do this and I can't do that. Like, where is like the most bang from your buck? Like if tomorrow you could do like 3 things to reduce your exposure, what would they be for you?
Yeah. Mostly get rid of your plastics, get rid of your fragrancy products. I know it's sad for a lot of people, but or switch them to, you know, good quality fragrances. And then finally, use a sauna. I mean, I really recommend it. In our modern culture, I think more people need to use the sauna. It has to be, it just has to be part of people's like daily routines, or at least weekly routines, I should say. I think the minimum effective dose is 3 times per week. So try and get in that sauna 3 times. I think those are the 3 big hitters. Do that stuff.
How long do you have to stay in there?
If you're at 180 degrees, you have to stay in there for 10 minutes. That's the minimum effective dose. But now if it's your infrared sauna, it's 150 degrees or something, it's probably 20 minutes. You want to sweat for 10 minutes. Try and sweat, you know, like, so I like to train hard in the gym first and then go in the sauna, and I immediately start sweating. And, you know, then I can just sit in there for 10 minutes at 180 and I'm good to go.
Yeah. And the important thing too with sauna use is that when you're done with the sauna, you don't want to go in the shower and wash off with your fragrance body wash.
You do want to wash off. Yeah.
Really like basic emollient soap and like rinse off and get the sweat off of your skin. Don't let it sit on there and reabsorb.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah. I know it makes me wonder like in the wooden benches in the sauna, like how much stuff is living in there. Can anything live in there? Is it hot enough? Like,
yeah, wash it out.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I want to switch for a minute and talk about some of the DNA consulting that you do, but sure. Just so that we're not switching subjects, you know, everybody knows I end every podcast with a semen analysis, and I pulled kind of this summary study on the impact of prenatal exposure to BPA on male reproductive function. And we've kind of alluded to, you know, some of the epigenetic multi-generational changes that can happen with exposure in pregnancy. And there's tons of cord blood studies. You guys can go look them up, you know, looking at the amount of these chemicals that are actually found in the cord blood, in the babies of pregnant mothers. But this, you know, study just highlighted that BPA is a recognized, you know, estrogen. And it also has not only estrogenic effects, but anti-androgenic properties. And that's what we've alluded to. It not only is a estrogen burden, but reduces testosterone and androgens. And it disrupts everything at the level of the estrogen receptor. Now it does have, you know, different affinity, like we talked about, to these receptors, and it may not be as potent sometimes as naturally occurring estrogen. But in the study, they highlighted that in Europe, the regulatory authorities said that the use of BPA in baby bottles was banned in 2011. But in the US today, we still use a ton of these chemicals. But they did this long-term follow-up study. It was a population from Western Australia using a birth cohort. And they looked at the exposure of BPA in sperm concentration and motility when the baby turned 20 years old. I mean, this is like a 20, you know, year study. And there was changes. So I think these are just things that we have to understand can have really long-term implications, not only for our health, but for your family's health. And nobody's perfect. Don't be overwhelmed. The more you can kind of start to clean up, you know, less polyester, less plastics, know where your water's coming from, you know, use glass and stainless steel instead of canned, you know, aluminum cans and things like that. I think that that's where you start for sure. Well, Dr. Anthony, tell us a little bit about the work that you do, consulting, you know, with DNA testing and like, what does that mean?
Yeah, I just use 23andMe data or ancestry data. I started doing it, I don't know, 12 years ago, because there's so much information in that data set. I mean, 23andMe, they test 650,000 SNPs and then they tell you have blue eyes, you know, and it's frustrating to me because there's so much interesting data there. So I sit down with people. I don't just send a report out because, you know, some people like yourself are super educated and, you know, you have a high level of all this understanding of the molecular mechanisms of what's going on. Some people need it simplified down, really simple. Here's what you really need to do, the actionable stuff. Some people need a little bit of coaching in there too, you know, like they're eating at McDonald's and, or whatever, you know, so like everybody's a little different. And so that's what I do. Basically, I even do DNA consulting for the special forces. I do it for a lot of pro athletes, but day to day, I do it for individual people, because mainly my goal is to just help people get healthier and at least understand the roadmap for being healthy. Like, for example, I had somebody yesterday at a factor five gene, and that's a gene where basically your blood is a little bit too thick, right?
And increase the blood clots.
Yeah, it causes a lot of blood clots, and especially at young ages. Like, I've had people with age 50 and they'll have a heart attack with that gene. And the medical community usually just waits until you have a heart attack and they say, oh shit, you have factor five. That's their approach for that gene. My approach is, well, oh, you're 30 years old and you've got factor five. Let's start taking a baby aspirin every day, right? It's very precise to prevent against that specific issue, and maybe even a little bit more of a blood thinner, like maybe some ginger or some curcumin or ginkgo. Those thin your blood at higher doses, and do an INR test and check your blood thickness and your prothrombin times, and look, have we thinned it enough to protect against any types of future strokes and blood clotting issues and thrombosis and heart attacks, right? So the goal is to prevent things from happening. Don't just wait until they happen. And so obviously nothing's perfect, right? Sometimes you're still going to get cancer. Like, it could just be shitty luck, and sometimes shitty things happen. But in general, there's a lot of stuff you can do to prevent health issues. And that's my goal with my consulting company.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. We, you know, it's like precision medicine, personalized medicine. And I think there's definitely a group of people out there that want to be proactive, you know. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. medicine's a sad world these days, because you can't help. I mean, some people just don't want to make these changes, but right. For people that do, mm-hmm. yeah, that's incredible. Well, tell people how to find your book, how to work with you if they want to do DNA consulting.
Yeah, thanks. So my book is on Amazon, Estrogeneration, How Estrogenics Are Making You Fat, Sick, and Infertile. Somebody came out with a knockout version of it, I think, with the exact title. And I think Amazon pulled it off, but just watch out for that. That was frustrating. But of course, it had like two reviews or something, and mine's got like 300 or something. So that's a dead giveaway. And then my consulting company, it's called ajconsultingcompany.com. That's my website there. And that, I also list personal care products there and stuff that I mentioned on that website.
Amazing. Well, you guys heard it here. This is a huge problem that you probably didn't think about. One we didn't talk about that I have talked about on my social media is thermal receipt paper. I read this study about the absorption of BPA from thermal receipts, old airline tickets, like before we had electronic boarding, and then how the absorption of the chemicals when you use alcohol-based hand sanitizers was like tenfold. So, like, and I just think, like, especially in the era of COVID, we're like, oh, let's just slather the alcohol hand sanitizer on our hands and like, we'll be good. And it actually makes you absorb all the chemicals.
Yep. Much worse. Yeah. Dermal absorption. Yeah. Skin absorption. Good point. And the masks too, to be honest, a lot of them are plastic. Stop using those plastic masks. You got a lot of time.
Well, this has been delightful.
You're popular.
And I want people to go check out your book. I know it's been out for a while and maybe there's people that have read it, but you guys, please share this podcast around with people so that they understand the implications of all this estrogen everywhere in our world. And Dr. Anthony Jay actually will be coming to Omaha later this year and speaking on some of these topics. So if you're interested, go check out Hard to Kill Summit, which is coming in August. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm looking forward to the conference.